President and Mrs. Bush, Talking with David Brunk, a special turn-of-the-year conversation which comes at the midpoint of this administration. We begin in the Oval Office.
Mr. President, last time we talked up at Kennebunk Court, you said...
Well, relax that, Mr. Speaker, without the formality of George Washington looking over
us. Just as beautiful, but slightly different, yes. And you mentioned then, modestly, you said at that point that you hadn't been tested by real fire. Now you really are being tested by real fire. And you could be forgiven for preferring it the other way around. But do you feel tested by real fire at this moment?
I feel testing because I've taken a very clear position regarding the Gulf crisis, strong international support for this position. Because of the role of the United States in the world, we have a disproportionate responsibility for the success of the objective, succeeding in the objectives outlined by the United Nations. But I think you could say it's a test. But I think it's a test to the world. What's at stake is world order. And there's a tremendous opportunity. But that opportunity will be lost if we don't succeed in implementing these UN resolutions without concession, implementing them to a T. And that's my objective, and we are going to prevail.
And as you analyze the man, the adversary at the other end, do you see Saddam Hussein as a survivalist, someone who in the end will make a pragmatic decision, i.e. smart, crazy, only like a fox, or do you see him as a potential martyr, a madman? When you make your calculations, how do you see him?
It's very hard to analyze because we get all kinds of reports from people that know him. His rhetoric is appalling. But one can't make determinations based on rhetoric. I'll tell you, David, it is my view that one, he doesn't know what he's up against, and two, he doesn't believe the willpower of the United States or the United Kingdom or France or Egypt or Saudi Arabia to use that power against him. I think on both fronts, he is still unconvinced. And so we click right on down to a deadline set by the United Nations.
Of January the 15th. And why did you decide we couldn't wait for sanctions?
Well, I haven't decided we can't wait for sanctions. Indeed, I've been waiting for the sanctions to have effect, and I think they're having some effect. But the more I look at the problem and the question, even both in terms of history and in terms of what's happening now, I am not convinced that sanctions alone will bring this man to his senses and will have international law respected. Because every time we talk about anything, we hear out of Iraq these outrageous claims that Kuwait is a province 19 of Iraq. And that, of course, is unacceptable to the entire world, including large majorities in the Arab world.
How much of Kuwait is there left to save?
Well, you hit me at an interesting time because I've just this day, coming down from Camp David to the White House, read almost in its entirety the Amnesty International report. And it should be compulsory reading for all of those that think we have all the time in the world, or all of those who say that's somebody else's problem. That's halfway around the world. The brutality, the rape, the pillage, the plunder, with case history to back it up, is appalling. And so to answer your question, I don't think we know.
What particularly struck you in that Amnesty report?
Oh, David, it was so terrible, it's hard to describe. Just to give you a little background on this, I handed it to Barbara as we left Camp David, and she read about two pages of it and said, I can't read anymore. But the torturing of a handicapped child, the shooting of young boys in front of their parents, the rape of women dragged out of the home and repeatedly raped and then brought into the hospital as kind of basket cases, The tying of those who are being tortured to ceiling fans so they turn and turn. The killing of a Kuwaiti and leaving him hanging. This is a picture of this one. Leaving him hanging from a crane and so others will see him. Electric shocks to the private, shocks to the private parts of the men and women. Broken glass inserted and jabbed into people. I mean, it is primeval. And I'm afraid I'd get very emotional if I described more of it. The hitting on, they call it falaga or something like, hitting on the bottom of the feet so 15-year-old kid can't walk. It's passing out of leaflets, and then for that, you're tortured so you can't even talk or move. It is outrageous what's happened.
It's genocide in a way.
Well, it is. It's a deliberate wiping them out. They asked in this report, they asked Saddam Hussein about it, and just brushes this off as well. Did you personally see it? And here's this report documented by eyewitness account after eyewitness account of a brutality that is close to unprecedented in history. You know, pulling out the fingernails and putting a device on the fingers to squeeze so the pain is just so intense it can't be stood. This is minor compared to what they're doing. And that's in there. That's all in this report. And we have to stand. We have to do something about this. You're asking about justice in Nuremberg. When the world sees this, there'll be an outcry against those individuals or those leaders that unleash this kind of fury on a battered neighboring country.
And that was what really put him beyond the pale as far as you were concerned.
Well, I think so. I think, of course, the aggression itself, where you go in, take over a weaker country, bully it, brutalize it, until he then says, this is province 19. The world's not going to accept that. The world shouldn't accept it. And if we don't do something about it today, we're going to live to pay a much greater price tomorrow. And I am absolutely firm in that.
A bigger price tomorrow when he has developed chemical and biological weapons.
Well,
and nuclear weapons.
Nuclear, chemical, biological. And if he succeeds in 1 inch of Kuwaiti territory, what does that mean after we take our troops out of there and the Brits come home and the French come home? What does it mean to the stability and security of the Gulf? What does it mean to Saudi Arabia? You know, we moved forces early. And we did it because when Saddam Hussein said, we are withdrawing from Kuwait, and he had one poor-looking little guy in a truck waving goodbye as the truck went north, and at the very same time, armor, personnel carriers, tanks moving down against the Saudi border. And now there's a few countries that are trying to have us accept a revisionistic view of history saying Saudi Arabia wasn't threatened. It was threatened, and unless the United Nations had come together and all of us had moved forces down there, I am convinced that he would have tried to take over Dhahran and the oil fields in Saudi Arabia.
He would have done that.
I'm convinced of it. And we had the photography to demonstrate it. We showed it to some who questioned it in the Middle East. What are these tanks doing going south when the man says he's withdrawing from Kuwait? The man is not to be trusted on his word, unfortunately.
So if between now and January the 15th he was to say that he would withdraw or start to withdraw from Kuwait,
not
even going to keep an island or keep part of an oil field, that's not acceptable.
May I say to you, certainly it's not acceptable to have some condition. And secondly, the United Nations resolution says out by January 15th. It refers back to the earlier resolutions, and it is clear. That's what international law now says. So it's halfway withdrawal, or I'll do it tomorrow. Excuses, that is not good enough.
Or I'll do it if you forgive a bit of my loans. That's not acceptable either.
That is acceptable. The United Nations talks about, I don't know if they use the word reparation.
Yes.
But clearly they talk about his having to make good on what he's done in the pillaging of Kuwait. And
they talk about reparations, which you'd be in favor of.
Well, clearly. I mean, we had our objectives that I've set out over and over again, and one of them is the security and stability of the Gulf, and the other one is total fulfillment of the United Nations resolution. So he has to make good on these things.
Why were we in the West so slow to sense the danger of Saddam Hussein, the tilt towards Iraq and all
of those?
We
were slow here. I think we were slow, David, because I think some of us felt maybe it's worth trying through renewed contacts and diplomacy and trade to bring him in to the family of peaceful nations. A lot of us felt that it was worth an extra effort. We had congressmen that went over and came back and talked to me, and they said, wait a minute, maybe we ought to try a little harder that route. And the next thing you do, having tried, you wake up and see that he's just brutal aggression without any rationale except some historic claim that he's making. And we can't. And that brought everybody to the one point that we can't condone it. We simply condemn it, and we are not going to permit it to stand.
And what happens after January the 15th? You have the choice, obviously, of taking action, consulting Congress for declaration of war or an authorization. What will you do after the 15th?
Well, I have made a determination, and I suppose if I had, I wouldn't advertise it, because we got a lot of lives at stake. We got an overwhelming force there. Overwhelming force. We got some of the best, they're all the best from our armed forces, and I went and talked to some from the UK, the Desert Rat. I didn't get to see the French troops, but I did get to see some of the Saudis and some of the Kuwaitis that are there. And these are strong, motivated young men and women. But I don't know. I wouldn't telegraph a punch. The UN resolution speaks for itself, and we will see where we go if he has not fully complied. But all options are open, and I've made this clear to the Congress in my consultations, which have been extensive, incidentally, and made it clear, I hope, to the world.
But you don't need an authorization from Congress.
Well, this is kind of an internal debate in the United States. We've used military force 200 times in history, and I think there have been 5 declarations of war. Having said that, I want the support of the Congress. I want Congress on board. We have, as you and I talk, strong support from the American people and a recognition that if he doesn't get out, military force might have to be used. So I would leave it somewhat hypothetical. But in the final analysis, I deal with the Congress on this, I think it's far less important than I want their support. I want their support for the United Nations, every single resolution, including the last one, and I can't complain so far. We've had good consultations, and they have not moved against me. The only resolutions that have been passed have been quite supported by the Congress itself.
In the event, in the relatively unlikely event, that Saddam Hussein withdraws in the way that you have demanded and the UN have demanded and so on, back into Iraq, can there ever be stability in the region as long as Saddam Hussein is in power in Iraq with a chemical, biological, possibly atomic capability? In other words, is the status quo ante enough?
No, it is not, and there will have to be some international order established to guarantee against future adventurism by him, to see that he does what the UN says in terms of the reparation and making whole those that he has brutalized. And thirdly, there will have to be some safeguard that this quest for a nuclear weapon and the further development of chemical weapons, which he has already used against these people, and biological, will stop in its tracks. I think the world will be united in that. So the status quo ante is unacceptable.
Yes, for some people inside it might be acceptable, but it's not.
Well, it's acceptable in the sense that he would not be subject to immediate military action against him.
When it comes to the question of war, obviously everybody's concerned about the loss of life, of course. But recently,
William Safire had a column headed The Final Sanction, pointing out that, in fact, before there is the danger of the loss of life of our ground forces and so on, that you do have a very powerful air option as well. In other words, if people are worried about the loss of life, as everybody is, the air option is a very powerful option for you, because Saddam Hussein says air power has never settled a war. But it could settle this one, couldn't it?
Saddam Hussein did not fight against the Iran without air cover. He had air cover. Without trying to sound bellicose, he would not have air cover of any kind. Should there be some conflagration? None at all. So we have awesome air power there, and I say we collectively, and we have awesome ground power there, and still moving, and that is because all of us collectively feel that if force has to be used, we want to minimize the loss of life. And so we're going to keep on doing this, and I think, I still hope that Saddam Hussein will get the message.
And the deadline is January the 15th, and people are watching this on January the 2nd and around the world on January the 3rd. He said a few weeks ago in an interview he thought the chance of war or military action was 50-50. What do you want to prepare the American people for tonight?
I would simply say to the American people what I've been saying. I want a peaceful resolution to this question. And I will keep working to achieve a peaceful resolution to this question. However, it cannot be done with compromise to him. It cannot be done by looking the other way in the face of this terror and brutality. I would also say to him, out of all this, however our success is determined, and it will be determined, we will prevail. There's no question about that. However that works out, there's a great promise of a new world order. And I just think that we have an enormous opportunity for a more peaceful world. It won't happen. It won't happen if we give one single inch to placate the aggressor, the dictator, the rapist of Kuwait. It won't happen if we compromise when you have such a clear case of good and good versus evil. You have such a clear moral case. The world sees it as a clear moral case. Come together, take in collective action at the United Nations, and we cannot stop one inch short of successful resolution.
And to those people who still remain to be convinced and say, why are we making the world safe for feudalism, or, you know, Kuwait's not a democracy, Saudi Arabia's not a democracy, would you be more comfortable if they were democracies?
Well, U.S. commitment to democracy, I guess, is as well known as any other principle around the world. But when you look at that part of the world, including Iraq, we are not looking at democracies now. So you have to put the case for what the case is about. And the case is about aggression. It is about stability and security in an area that is vital to the rest of the world. I'll tell you what brought it home to me, David. I talked to Václav Havel, and he says this is costing his small country $1.5 billion. Here's a playwright. Here's an erudite intellectual who is steadfast in support of what we all are doing. And he says to me, we've been there. We've seen what unchecked aggression can do. Recently, I went down to South America. I talked to President Collor in Brazil. He estimates the cost of his fragile economy, $5 billion, because of what this madman has done halfway around the world. A small country like Uruguay, President Macaya is telling me, it is, I forget the word he used, but very, very oppressive what's happened to him. But Chile, whose economy is a little ahead of others, being driven, hurt badly by this aggression. So you have not only the moral question of aggression and fundamental violation of human rights, but you also have an economic consideration.
As well as that. Right. Some people say the cost is very high, that this coalition, in the course of this coalition, Syria has taken over Lebanon, Libya dominates Chad, $7 billion debt forbidden to Egypt, Saudi making a profit on oil every year, suspended Jackson Vanek, legitimized the government of Syria by meeting with them, ended the human rights isolation of China, and so on, and that list is too expensive.
That list, some of that list is totally unrelated to the aggression of Saddam Hussein against Kuwait. But let me just put it in theoretical terms here. Standing up against this aggression, no price is too heavy to pay for it, because we have the promise now of a much more peaceful world, and we have the threat that this aggression is rewarded of worse price to pay tomorrow. It is that clear in my mind. It is that clear that if we don't check this aggression, and if the United Nations fails, and all of us therein, therefore, it would follow, fail in our responsibility, the price tag tomorrow will be far greater than the price tag today. And the reward tomorrow of a chance for lasting peace and for stability and security in the Gulf and a new world order will have been foregone. And so it is. It's that important. Nothing like this since World War II. Nothing of this moral importance since World War II.
People said about the thing we discussed earlier about tilting towards Iraq in the war with Iran, that we made the classic mistake of the old Arab saying about the enemy of my enemy is my friend and so on. Is there a danger that we're doing that with President Assad now?
I don't think so. I have big differences with him, and so do other countries have differences. But in this case, we agree with him. In this case, we agree with him that Saddam Hussein's aggression must not stand. He is looking at this question of the invasion of a neighboring state the same way we are. So when you have that common ground, you pull together. And out of that pulling together, let's hope we'll have a new base from which we can talk and eliminate our differences. I met him over in Geneva. It was the right thing to do, and I had a good talk with him. But in during that talk, I bring up the differences that we have had and still have with Syria. But then we have some common ground to talk about, and that common ground related to the failure of Saddam Hussein, the fact that he must fail.
If it takes military action, would you hope that it will all be over in less than a month?
Well, I would hope it'd be over in a few days, but what happens realistically is hard to tell. And when one does planning of alternatives and working with one's allies, one considers the downside. So I'm not predicting one way or another, but I'll say this to those, particularly in my country, who are concerned. This will not be another Vietnam. The forces used, the general's hands will not be tied behind them. This concept of, well, you can do only so much, but not more. That, as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, is unacceptable to me.
And assuming this crisis is resolved, how long have you got to budget in your plans for our having some troops, some presence there, some Gulfo to replace NATO, I mean, or to go alongside NATO? How long are you budgeting that you may need to have some troops around there?
I'm not budgeting for that at all. And I think particularly in this area, it is essential that we bring every single soldier, airman, and marine out of there as quickly as possible. Now, you notice I didn't say sailors, because the United States has had a naval presence there. It has been a stabilizing presence. It is guaranteed, along with other countries, it is guaranteed free passage through the Straits of Hormuz. And I visualize that we will continue to have a naval presence. But I want every single foot soldier and airman out as soon as possible for a lot of reasons, including cultural reasons in the area. And I'm glad we raised this, because I think some countries, Iran perhaps, or other countries in the area, might worry that this will lead to a continued U.S. presence. And as far as I'm concerned, it will not. I can't give you a time frame because I don't know what this situation will be, but I want them all home as soon as possible. And then if that means a UNIFIL-type peacekeeping force, the United States would be very pleased to support such a force.
Before returning to the president, we talk next to Mrs. Bush in the Roosevelt Room.
Arguably, Barbara, I think that the quote of the year was your quote at Wellesley. Mm. At the end of your life, you will never regret not having passed one more test, not winning one more verdict, or not closing one more deal. You will regret time not spent with a husband, a child, a friend, or a parent.
Well, I think it's true. I think what happens in your house is more important than what happens in the White House. I really believe that. Mm. And as George said earlier, I think to you, we've certainly been lucky, both he and I. It's very important.
We didn't have time to talk very much about the subject of race, but just en passant, as it were. But that's something, the question of race relations in America, that concerns you both.
It concerns me a lot, but it concerns him enormously. I mean, for the past, I think, since 1948, George and I have both, particularly George, been very active in United Negro College Fund and in Hispanic affairs. So that's been an enormous interest of George's all of our married life.
What's the key to being colorblind?
That's a very hard question because everybody's different. But I know, and George Bush knows, that all people are equal, and they must be treated that way. And I think we're lucky because we know people who cross every spectrum of color and love them. And no, it has nothing to do with color. It has to do with what's inside.
You also said it well, too, that life must have joy. Do you think there's an element of joy lacking in our national life at the moment? I mean, we read so much about problems, and they're real problems. People are right to write about problems if they exist. But do you think we've lost the element of joy?
I think some people, not many, but have put the wrong emphasis on their lives. And joy is a very important part. It doesn't have much to do with money. It doesn't have much to do with maybe two cars. It has to do with loving each other and doing for other people. And I'm not saying don't work hard. What I'm saying is enjoy it when you do it.
Mm.
Have fun.
And in your Wellesley speech, you did that marvelous joke about the woman president and the spouse and the payoff to the punchline at the end. But the audience were 20 to 25 years old. Does that mean we may have to wait 25 years for a woman's president?
I don't know. I plan to be around, so let's say I'm 65. I'm going to vote for her if she's a Republican, and might not be 25 years. I might not still be voting past that time.
But it's going to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, look at Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi, and the right woman will come along, and there's a lot of luck and a lot of skill and a lot of wisdom that goes into it, but she'll be there, and we'll know her when we see her.
I was amazed to read, since we were last together, that you mentioned that when you left China, of all the people in the world who I would thought would never suffer from depression, that you conquered depression over a six-month period.
I mean, it's been made into a mountain.
It's been made into a mountain.
But I did have a little depression. But I now realize that there were a lot of reasons, probably, but it was tiny. But it just made me more sympathetic to other people. And what I'm saying to people is, if you have a depression, go see your doctor. I was too proud and a little stupid, too. And you ought to go see your doctor and talk to him about it and find out. And thrust yourself into other projects. That's really how I got over it. I stopped thinking about and started thinking again about others. And that makes the big difference in life.
So that was one of the other things you said at Wellesley about what big challenge to get into, and you chose literacy and so on. What were the other ones that you could have chosen?
I myself chose literacy because I suddenly decided that all of those things I worried about, drugs, pregnancy, homeless, hunger, all could be at least helped if more people could read, write, and understand. Now, since I've gotten into literacy, AIDS has come up. I'm absolutely convinced that we have to educate our people. You have to know how to read, write, and understand to avoid things like AIDS.
Mm-hmm. And you visited that tragic funeral of Ryan White.
I did go.
Do you think we're making any progress on AIDS, really?
Yes.
I say that not politically.
Yes.
I say that.
No. Yes, I think so. I think certain groups, as I understand it from statistics, are getting educated about AIDS. We just need to educate more people. One of the problems we have, you know, is not how not to get AIDS, but it's how to treat people with AIDS. And I've done a little bit of that, trying to explain that you can't get AIDS from hugging or patting or touching. That's not the way you get AIDS. And that if a little kid has AIDS, you've got to treat him like any other little kid. Or if a big kid has AIDS, he can still work, he can still live in his apartment. They should be treated normally.
It's that fear of the unknown, isn't
mm-hmm,
it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's why you need to be educated, so you don't have that fear.
Mr. President, here we are at the turn of a year and the midpoint of the administration. What would be your report card on the Bush administration so far?
Done a lot and lots left to do. I think that we've made some big strides. We see our own hemisphere here, totally democratic, except for one visible exception, Cuba. It's an exciting time to be president, and yet we've got lots left to do.
And in terms of the report card, when I had my report card, there was always a section that said, could do better. What would come in that section?
Well, I think fulfilling some of these goals. We've started on education, but there's lots left to do. We've got a national drug strategy, and the wonderful thing is drug use, cocaine use, is starting down, but we haven't completed it. I sent a crime bill up to the Congress, and we got part of it, but not all of it. So we are halfway home, or halfway towards the completion of this four-year term, and I think we've made a good start on a lot of things. Failed to do one or two things, but it's going all right. We're in a slowdown economically in this country, if not recession. In some areas, we're clearly in recession. And this concerns me because people are hurting.
What are you going to do about it?
Well, what I'm going to do about it is to propose certain broad approach to economic matters that will, I think, enhance growth. But I believe that the worst, last thing we ought to do about it is have a lot of spending programs aimed to, quote, put America back to work, unquote. These short-range government spending answers have historically proved counterproductive, and I will not embrace them. And if they send them down from Capitol Hill, a lot of big new spending programs, I will veto them, because we don't need that. I happen to believe, and I think most economists believe, that the recession will be mild, and that the whole country will come out of it in not too many months from now. But I have no plan to spend a lot of new federal dollars in order to accelerate recovery.
The trouble is, of course, these predictions, like the predictions about budget deficits, these economic predictions are notoriously unreliable, aren't they?
Well, they are, but I see no evidence of a deep recession. And so as fast as we talk, I see evidences of some pockets of our economy that are extraordinarily strong.
If you've got one arm sort of behind your back in a way, the traditional way out of a recession is increasing government spending, which with the spending caps and so on, you reject. Or you reduce interest rates, but I mean, the interest rates have to stay up to attract money to pay for the deficit and so on. So you've got one arm less than usual, haven't you?
No, because I do think as you see the interest rates starting down, that will be the best antidote to recession. And they are starting down. And the budget agreement, which was quite controversial, says this to the world market. The United States will be borrowing $492 billion less than the international markets because of the budget agreement. And it is enforceable. So I still believe it was the right thing to do. God knows I've taken some political grief from it. But that's unimportant. If we've contributed to the soundness of the U.S. economy, I think we have with that.
Do you think what was variously called the budget debacle or fiasco was partly self-inflicted as you look?
Probably. Because I was really, I'd say, forced to accept a tax increase, which I, like a kid taking castor oil, for me, I don't like that. But Ronald Reagan went through the same thing in 81, economy recovered, and everybody lived happily ever after. And the same thing will happen here.
Isn't there between two, Mr. President, the most passionate phrases you believe in, a real dialectical conflict that between a kinder, gentler America and no more taxes, aren't the two mutually contradictory?
No. It's only mutually contradictory if you think government is the be-all and end-all. If we could really get control of government spending, which is taking a significant percentage of our GNP, the kindest and gentlest answer would be an economy so vigorous that everybody, instead of having to reach out for a welfare check, would have a job in the private sector with the attendant dignity, the dignity that would go with that. So I don't see conflict in that regard. If you believe, however, that some of the political left in this country does, and I think it's been a little bit of a thesis of the Democratic Party, that we need to spend more in order to enhance the lives of American people, then you might say that there's a conflict.
Don't you sometimes want to spend more on education?
Sure.
On the environment?
Not so much on education. The environment, we've just enacted a very comprehensive clean air bill, the most significant environmental legislation ever enacted, with a large price tag on the private sector. I hope it's not so large that it slows the private sector down. I don't think it will. I think we've found the balance between economic growth and sound environment here. But if you said to me, there's some clinics over there that need more money for drug rehabilitation, and they could use another $100,000, would you like to be able to spend it? Certainly.
How can you find it?
Well, I think we find it by having the most vigorous economy possible, so that the revenues that are coming in exceed entitlements and other expenditures that are already on the book. That's the way you do it. That's the philosophical way you do it. We're not taxing the American people too little. We continue to spend too much on some categories. But if we can get the growth restored and hold the line so we don't just go spend on some new wonderful idea of a program, then I think you'll have additional funds that you can put into these really worthwhile programs.
And so despite the fragility of the banks, despite the burden of the interest on the deficit, despite the extra expenses in the Gulf and all of those things, you're still confident that this recession will be all over in 6 to 9 months?
Well, I that's what the projections of most of the blue-chip projectors seem to indicate 6 months. But I don't want to get pinned down on that. All I want to say is that I believe the recession or the decline, whatever you want to call it, yet I'm being a little careful because we have not been decreed in a recession, national recession. But
no,
whatever it is,
no, in terms of the
two quarters.
But if you're running a small business, whether it's called a downturn or a recession,
right,
you've got problems, haven't you?
That's right. And the guy next door might be doing fairly well. So we've got to keep remembering that at this juncture, you know, some are doing well, some are doing very badly. I'm worried about it. because I want to see us come out of it. And but I would say short-lived, and maybe that time frame that you mentioned there will prove to be accurate. I hope it is. I hope it does.
In terms of the no more taxes, in terms of I'd like to have more money to do more things and so on, isn't there only one obvious solution, which is a peace dividend? I mean, to really attack defense spending.
A dividend is when you take earnings and spread it around. That's what I used to think of as a dividend. When I'm not an economist, but I studied economics at Yale University. And I was in business. When I thought of a dividend, I thought, hey, you've made a profit. Therefore, you ought to pay that out to your shareholders. We are in a big deficit. We are not in a dividend-paying mode. If you use the traditional definition of dividend.
But if you can save some money on defense.
We have saved a tremendous amount.
Well, can't we save a lot more? We're now dealing with regional threats, the new world order, and no world threats of the same scale. Can't we save more?
The deficit reduction plan reduced debt, the defense budget by billions of dollars. And I think we have an obligation, perhaps a disproportionate obligation, to keep a credible defense. And I'm determined to do that, and that is a fundamental responsibility, as I see my job, of any president.
Margaret Thatcher said that she thought that the worst was over for Mr. Gorbachev. Other people say that his problems get greater all the time. Where do you put yourself in that?
I'm inclined to be... I mean, if I had to choose between one camp or the other, I'd probably say there is still a deterioration. As you know, we have a very good relationship with the Soviet Union, and that means with its president, President Gorbachev. But as these republics assert more and more removal from the center, independence, you might say. And as the economic conditions get worse, I think these problems are getting more complicated. Ironically, there's a marvelous new relationship in which we can talk very frankly. I can talk to President Gorbachev very frankly about this. And so I'm not sure the worst is past. And I'm worried about this winter and the deprivation that goes with a tough winter on the people inside the Soviet Union. And so we're trying in a modest way to help, and others are trying to help. But what is the main basis? Nothing to do with how this whole system changes the President and Glasnost will resolve themselves. But we should stand up to help, and we're trying to.
And in terms of people talk of the 10,000 or 12,000 nuclear warheads, if the Soviet Union wants to disintegrate, is that per se dangerous?
I think the Soviets are concerned about that. I think that they have pretty good and effective safeguards now to protect the nuclear weapons. But I don't know enough about that to say yes or no. If you made the case that some madman would emerge and control the nuclear arsenal, of course you would argue that would be terribly dangerous for the whole world. I don't believe that I would predict that kind of state.
And as you say, you can talk to President Gorbachev in a way that would have been inconceivable years ago.
One example of that difference. We go to Paris. He comes to the embassy. And I said, let's put a little den up there. There's Barbara all lined up to get the handshake and the picture with a lot of her friends there that were visiting with Ambassador Curley's wife. And I'm not sure President Gorbachev knew what we were going to get into, but we sat in the couch. Well, one guy on my side, another, a couple of interpreters. And we had the most productive and pleasant and relaxed meeting that I've ever had with him. And the next day, it comes up chilly reception between Bush and Gorbachev. All over the world, the reason was that Gorbachev at that juncture was not prepared to say publicly that he was able to support this last United Nations resolution. And so it was all written with this great sense of controversy that is that all those countries were coming apart. And of course, it worked just the opposite. And I took a little heat by saying, believe me, the meeting was cordial, and then a few days later, the Soviets were able to announce that they would be supportive, or that we're all together on this UN resolution. But it was a good lesson to me, because I was there. I know it was a warm meeting. Joke, humor, as well as a lot of substance. But it wasn't a chilly meeting. Wonderful. Wonderful. P.S. All you listeners, don't believe everything you read.
Not everything you read in the papers. Only what you see on television. Now that things are so serious and there's so many serious issues at the moment, is life in the White House any different to what it was a few months ago?
No. No, it's not. I mean, it's hard for people to go by the outside here on Pennsylvania Avenue and look at the White House, the people's house, to think that inside that magnificent building, not large by the standards of European palaces, but nevertheless magnificent to all Americans, that you can have a normal family life.
Talking of all this flying that you've been doing at the end of the year, I mean, do you get frequent flyers out to Air Force One or not?
No, actually, again, I make it so easy for the President of the United States that it doesn't seem that it's any ordeal at all. And I've gotten them, I think, for this year, so frequently flying. But we have to do it. We cannot neglect our own hemisphere. We obviously have tremendous interest in Europe. And who knows, I'll probably end up in Asia this year. And I want to go down to Australia. And so, you know, a president has to do it. You don't take your friends for granted. You're in the White House, it's a human level or international.
We were talking earlier on about this unique club that, for instance, that the President and President Gorbachev are part of. As you watch both of them over the past 2 years, do these men with great responsibilities, do they change?
I don't think yours has changed.
And I hope I've learned something, I mean.
Well, of course you've learned, but I mean, I'm talking about the level of being frantic or not. You're not frantic.
Let me try this one, part of it. What changes is if you get to know somebody on a personal basis, there is this more relaxed factor where you can talk more openly and without fear of misunderstanding. It's certainly true between me and Mr. Gorbachev. I'm confident it was true with Mrs. Thatcher and will be true with John Major. It is clearly true with my friend Francois Mitterrand, Helmut Fenn, Mitterrand, Cole. And so the more contact you have, particularly if you can do it without the formality of the cabinet room over there, the better it is. Not that they're going to change their view if they like you, or that I'll change my view if I like them. But you can talk with a frankness. You minimize the risk of two ships passing in the night because of misunderstanding.
What do you feel about the 90s versus the 80s in values? I mean, people talk about the 80s, that the hero symbols were Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky and Donald Trump and so on, and that was a sort of acquisitive greed generation. Do you think this is a different, more selfless decade or not?
I think people are looking more towards family, David. I really do. At least that's what people think of me about, but people always talk to me about, thank you for bringing back family.
I hope so.
I mean, we feel that's so important, and you can't teach that.
picked up to do that by osmosis, I guess.
We were talking about that in the other room. Family, faith, one nation under God. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much cynicism about all that. It's a reality, and I think this is almost a rediscovery of it, because everyone seems to agree that the diminution of family is detrimental to our stability and to our goodness. I think.
And you said before, and you often say that you, particularly obviously with the possibility of war, but in any case, that you pray every night and so on. And,
yeah.
And what does that prayer give you both?
Strength. We are believers.
Comfort.
And we believe you should be.
I hate to be present. If you didn't have something other than self, or other than self and wife, or other than self and family to lift you up. And I can much more clearly understand why Lincoln, at a very critical time, talked about the time he spent on his knees. It's like confession. And in a corner, but the prayers were often said flat, not on the knees, which is maybe a confession I couldn't make here, but it's the fact that you pray.
And it reminds you to try to do better. It reminds you to do what you were talking about before, which is have love in your heart for everybody. No color barriers, no religious barriers, no barriers. That's what it reminds me. Just one.
Now, you're going to run again, obviously, for second term.
Now, David, what would lead an intelligent interviewer like you to reach that conclusion?
Well, I don't know, just a crazy wild beard.
I'll say
crazy wild
beard
of mine.
It seems to be the pattern that I and in all likelihood I probably will, but there is no Rubicon crossed on that one. But I would expect so. But who knows? Who knows?
What could interfere with it? Nothing.
You hit me down there and this doesn't jump up, for example. My health. But my determination has never been at a higher point. My health is strong and good. But I'd look at this at the appropriate time and think, do I have a right to ask the American people for 4 more years mandate? And I expect I will feel that way. But I can't tell you that I've made that determination. And I'm not some kind of hypochondriac either. I never felt better, but I must say that if something occurred that made me think I wouldn't have the energy to go the extra mile, to be walking in that door at 7 o'clock in the morning and not leave till maybe one of the last in this building, then I wouldn't want to do it, because I know what I've got to do the job right. Others can do it differently. But I know what I have to do is be able to go, give them 100%. And I'm right or wrong on an issue, and that would be a determining factor that might make me argue the other way, the other side of it.
Would you expect there to be, would you budget for a possible conservative challenge to your nomination?
Well, this is a marvelously open system here, and people are free to do anything they would want. But I would expect if I concluded I would want to run again, that I would get the nomination, and I expect I'd win.
And who?
I say that without arrogance, but I just feel that's the way it would be.
And
I'll tell you, if I make that determination, I'll go all out. I'll come in the fight of my life, which I probably would. Probably would, but it's primary process. Let them slug it out. Let them walk through the snows of Iowa and New Hampshire and try to figure it out. But they don't need me fine-tuning. It's the last thing that, you know, that would be constructive. But I, as I look at it, as one who loves politics and obviously has a little bit of a stake in this, is what happened. I'm not sure that the field has been narrowed to any formulation of that nature.
A last question.
So what I mean is I'm dodging your question.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I just wanted
elegantly.
Yes,
elegantly.
I thought I did it.
And
well.
Eloquently.
It's the first time anyone has accused me of being eloquent. Other things, hardworking maybe, but not eloquent.
Susan, yes.
I like that. I like it as I deal with the economy. I like it as I deal with the Middle East. I owe prudence to the families of these kids over there in the Gulf. If we ever had to use force, I would want it to be done so that the life of every single American kid and every desert rat that's out there and every French soldier and every Saudi and every Moroccan and every Egyptian and every Syrian would have his or her life guaranteed as best as possible.
Mr. President, thank you very much indeed.